Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for December 23, 2004. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And, wow, hurricane conditions out there. Really wacky rain and winds. I feel like I'm going to swim down here. This is the last live show of 2004. I'll be here on recording next week, off celebrating the holidays. But we'll be looking at already recorded the interview, so I know what it's all about. All about inequality in the U.S. What causes it, what public attitudes towards it are, and what might be done about it. And with a special look at the contribution of corporate policies to the increase in inequality over the last 30 years. Interview with Leslie McCall, who teaches sociology and women's studies at Rutgers University. But that's next week. This week, two interviews. First, in about 5 or 7 minutes or so, an interview with Maya Rockymore, who is a researcher with the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation, talking about Social Security privatization with a special emphasis on its effects on black Americans. And then at the bottom of the hour, interview with Merrill Guzner, who is at the Center for Science of the Public Interest, one of those Naderite organizations in D.C., and he'll be talking about the recent recalls of some drugs, Vioxx and Celebrex, and what that's all about, and also relations between the industry and the medical profession, relations between the industry and the Food and Drug Administration, and also why the pharmaceutical industry is one of the most profitable pursuits on this planet. That's about 25 minutes from now. Before we get to that, though, a couple of economic headlines. First, the weekly tally of first-time claims for unemployment insurance, a very sensitive indicator of the state of the job market, was up by 17,000 last week. But the week-to-week fluctuations between Thanksgiving and New Year's are very hard to read. A lot of holiday distortions. The Labor Department does attempt to correct for those holiday distortions with things called seasonal adjustment. But it's an imperfect science, so it does look like the labor market is in decent shape. Not great, but not falling apart either. So modest job growth seems to be prevailing. But we will get a better picture of that in early January when we get those jobless claims numbers, minus the seasonal distortions and also the December employment report coming out the first Friday in January. And it will be interesting to see. Generally, a lot of employers hold off on layoffs until after the new year. They don't want to lay people off at Christmas time. So we don't really know exactly what's going on at the labor market until that is over. Also, it's possible that a number of retailers are having a disappointing Christmas season, so they may be shutting their doors or reducing their operations come January, too. So those will be important to see the post-holiday fallout. But consumer confidence also picking up. The weekly ABC Money magazine tally of that up a point to -5, which is a little above the series average, I think. It's been improving for the last several weeks after an unexpected decline in November, but that's been picking up so far in December. And the monthly tally from the of consumer attitudes from the University of Michigan, that also up almost well over 4 points from November's level, the strongest increase since June, consumers showing better expectations for the future. So it does seem that the improvement in the job market and some decline in gas prices improving consumer attitudes, but it doesn't seem like people are spending with both fists this holiday season, so we shall see. But at least it seems that some of the signs of weakness that the economy showed over the summer and into the fall may be dissipating now. Personal income in the month of November up just 0.3%. That's very weak wage growth, 0.2%, the slowest since June. Personal income doing it's positive, but not growing like gangbusters. People still relying rather heavily on borrowed money to finance consumption. And the Mortgage Bankers Association reporting that its index of mortgage refinancings, which are what people often use to take money out of their appreciated houses and spend it on things like lumber or SUVs or whatever, that refi index up in the latest week. but the purchase index down. Fewer people buying houses, and also the Census Bureau reporting this morning that new home sales in the month of November were down about 12% from October. So it does look like the housing market, which has been quite hot, is cooling somewhat. We'll see how far that goes, and if it has a negative effect on the overall level of economic activity. It has been one of the driving forces of the economy in the last couple of years, as people feel richer as their home values increase, but also people borrowing money very heavily against those increased values and spending it. So if that slows down as interest rates rise, as the Fed pushes up interest rates, then we'll see if that results in a slower consumption than we've seen in the past couple of years. The Economic Cycles Research Institute, their weekly leading index for the U.S. economy, off a little bit last week, but it is has been picking up, and so it is way off its depths of October. So it does look like the period of slowdown in the U.S. economy may be ending. We could see an acceleration in a new year, but there are many wild cards in that, particularly the attitudes of foreign investors who've been financing our overconsumption for years now. And if they cease to do that, then there may be some belt tightening underway in the United States, but that hasn't happened yet. Also, the Conference Board's index of leading indicators up in November, ending a string of five straight declines. So it does seem that at least the slowdown in the U.S. economy has maybe coming to an end and maybe turning a corner and picking up a little speed. Some news from abroad. The unemployment rates in both Brazil and Mexico rising in November. Economy.com, who does has a service that sends you email notices of economic releases, which is how I know about a lot of these things. They described the unemployment rate in Brazil as increasing a skosh. I have no idea what a skosh is, but that's also a tenth of a point. So up slightly in Brazil, we'll see if that is the beginning of a weakening in the Brazilian labor market, which had been the unemployment rate had been coming down fairly steadily from its peak in March and April. So we'll see if that decline is over. Mexico also probably feeling some fallout from the weaker slowdown in the U.S. economy in recent months, and their unemployment are also rising two skoshes, I guess, from 3.6 to 3.8%. But that's a fairly meaningless number since it doesn't include a lot of people who are not in the formal economy. The Mexican labor market very full of people who are combing garbage heaps and selling pencils on street corners, and they don't really figure in the labor market statistics. So don't believe that 3.8% unemployment rate, but the direction of it is probably meaningful. If it's rising, then means harder times for Mexican workers. But it too, like the Brazilian rate, had been falling. So we'll see if that's the end of that improvement or something longer term. Happening. So let's take a little break with some music to set up the next interview, and we'll be back to talk about Social Security.
People try to put us down.
Talking about my generation.
Just because we get around.
Talking about my generation.
Things they do look awful.
Talking about my generation.
I hope I die before I get old.
Talking about my generation.
Just my generation, baby. Why don't you all fade
away?
Don't try and dig what we all say. I'm not trying to cause a big sensation. I'm talking about my generation.
Of course, The Who, singing a bit of their 1960s hit, My Generation. And that's what the Social Security thing is all about. My generation, the baby boomers, will soon be starting to retire. Most of us didn't die before we got old, and so there may be some funding burden on the system. And as George Bush pushes to privatize it in the coming months, we'll be covering that very closely. And here's an installment of that coverage, an interview with Maya Rockymore, who is the senior researcher at the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation in Washington, D.C., an author of a piece on the effects of Social Security reform on black Americans in particular, at the Black Commentator website, an excellent website, which everyone who hasn't visited yet should, theblackcommentator.com. So let's listen to this interview with Maya Rockymore, recorded earlier this week.
Welcome to WBAI. Before we get to the specific topic of the impact of Social Security reform on African Americans, could we get your view of the whole project in general, the whole project of Social Security reform? What do you think of it?
Well, Social Security reform as constructed by the Bush administration and other elements who believe in privatizing the system is not reform at all. When those who care about Social Security talk about reform, it's about shoring up the long-term Social Security shortfall that's expected in the year 2052. That's when Social Security will only be able to pay out 80 cents on every dollar in benefits promised. Yet those who want to privatize the system and under the guise of reform say that they want to enact reform. What they're talking about is taking money away from the Social Security system to create private individual accounts and send that money to Wall Street. This blows a hole in Social Security, does not solve the problem of this long-term shortfall, and blows a hole in the budget deficit as well.
What are the motives, do you think?
Well, the motives, you know, seem to be several-fold. Unfortunately, there is a contingency out there who have never liked Social Security. They have resented the program, even though it has worked. It has done its job of making sure that older people who can no longer work have security, economic security, so they don't have to live on the streets. So, you know, they're resentful of the program because even the wealthy have to pay into it. And they're, even though those wealthy individuals do not have to pay past a certain point, $87,000, they resent their contribution. There are also those who understand that this is a move to further enrich the rich. Moving massive amounts of taxpayer dollars from the Social Security trust funds to Wall Street will make those money managers on Wall Street even wealthier because they will be charging administrative fees that can run anywhere up from 10 to 20% of the amount in individual accounts. And, of course, you know, there are those who also point to the fact that private companies for some time now have been moving away from giving defined benefit pensions, that is, where individuals get a guaranteed benefit based on what they pay in, to a defined contribution program, which means that individuals contribute. That's their only guarantee that they can contribute, but they don't know what they're going to get out because it's based on the market. So that puts the burden of retirement on the individual, and there are those who believe that those in power who believe in privatizing the system want individuals to be more responsible for their retirement in the future.
Well, that appeals to a certain kind of American common sense. We should all take responsibility for ourselves and not rely on the government. What do you say to people who make that argument?
Well, Social Security is the prime example of how we're taking responsibility for ourselves because it's not a welfare program. People fail to realize that. This is not SSI, and people get that confused. People pay into Social Security to get back their benefits in the end. So we're paying for the benefits that we get. And people need to realize it's an earned benefit. It is not charity. It is not welfare. And Social Security, so it's a prime example of a program that works because we do pay into it and we get out what we get. But it's even better because it's this comprehensive insurance program. It's not just about retirement benefits. If you become disabled in the middle of your working life, Social Security steps in to provide disability benefits. If you, heaven forbid, die in the middle of your working life, you don't have to worry about how your spouse or your dependent children will get along because Social Security is there to provide that insurance in the event that that happens and step in and provide a base of support for your dependents as well. So it is a comprehensive family insurance plan. And those who like to portray it as, how much return are you getting out for your retirement, are completely missing the point that this is a multifaceted program that's very important for American families.
And now let's get to the specific impact on African Americans of some kind of reform, and we know what reform means in this context. But why does this? Why is there a special racial angle to the project of Social Security reform?
Yeah, because there's a special racial angle because we have traditionally had discrimination in this country, as you know. Black folks will come over here as slaves, and then that means that we're behind in terms of our level of education. We're behind in terms of our integration to the labor market. And continued discrimination has meant that we are less likely to have other assets or income-bearing assets upon retirement. We're less likely to have private pensions because of labor market discrimination. We're less likely to have other forms of income. So Social Security is, upon retirement, a very important source of income. Actually, 40% of African-American seniors is the only source of retirement income for 40% of African-American seniors. So that means the stability of a Social Security check is very important for these seniors based on their history in this country and in the labor market. But there's also another racial angle, and that is because of the discrimination in our health care system. Recall that we have an employer-based health care system in this country. You know, African Americans, Hispanic Americans, and Asian Americans are, you know, approximately 29% of the U.S. population, but we are 52.2% of the nation's more than 35 million uninsured people. That means that we don't have health insurance, and that translates into early disability, higher disability rates, and early death. So that means that the disability insurance portion of Social Security and the survivor portion of Social Security become very, very important for people of color and their families.
Now, I've actually seen the cynical argument made that because black people have shorter life expectancies than white people, they actually get a worse deal from the Social Security system. How do you respond to that sort of thing?
And that is, again, privatizers who are only focusing on the retirement angle of Social Security. When you look at the program as a whole in terms of its comprehensive insurance benefits for survivor, disability, and retirement, it's a good deal for African-American families. Now, the deal was, so if you want to keep African-Americans, if you want to give them a better deal, fix the health care system. Yet nobody on the privatization side is talking about that. In fact, what they are proposing is to raise the retirement age even under privatization plans. They have no program in place to make it easier for African-Americans to access retirement benefits under privatization. Even they are talking about raising the retirement age. So it really is a disingenuous argument that they're making. If they really want to close the asset, the wealth and gap in the African-American community, deal with the basic problems we have in education and access to health care and labor market reform.
In your piece on the Black Commentator website, you say that privatization destroys communities. What do you mean by that?
It goes back to the whole social insurance thing. Believe it or not, you and I enjoy a higher living standard because we don't have to necessarily worry about paying for the full cost of our aging parents or grandparents. As previous generations before Social Security were put in place did have to, you know, they had to worry about it. So the fact that, you know, we have something that is there to help us, be cohesive in terms of it having economic support over the generations helps us. It helps us have a higher living standard. In terms of communities, the whole notion of having this comprehensive benefit that is important for people whose fathers or mothers have passed away, the children who rely on these benefits, for women who are aging and they live long and they no longer have any family there for them. This is social insurance at its best. That means that everybody contributes to a program that views us as America, as a society of people who all recognizing that we all need support in one way or another. And so Social Security is a comprehensive social insurance program that helps build communities by providing an economic base of support for all.
Now, what you're saying sounds like you're making an argument about solidarity of community, and a lot of the privatizers are really making arguments about individual self-reliance, one's fending for oneself. What do you think about the different value systems behind these two approaches?
I think that is indicative. It goes to the very heart of the matter. Basically, they're trying to break the social link that we all have and make everybody, every person, man, woman, and child, fend for yourselves. But we have seen historically how this has not worked. Prior to the 1930s when Social Security was created, we saw that every man, woman, and child did not have, I mean, if for some reason, heaven forbid, a father passed away and left their dependent spouse and children behind, they struggled for support, for welfare support or any other way that they could bring make ends meet. You know, same for elderly people. If they did not have family, if they did not have children, or they did not have family that could take care of them, they were out on the streets begging for alms. And in terms of, you know, the notion of every individual for themselves, as the wealthiest nation in this world, we can do better than that, and we have done better than that through Social Security, and it makes no sense to me why they want to, the privatizers want to turn back the hands of time to return us to a time where those who are less fortunate have to basically fend for themselves.
I think a lot of these people have a fondness for pre-Civil War America, but let's conclude with the political prospects. You're in Washington. You work with the Congressional Black Caucus. The Republicans have a large congressional majority. They have the White House. Can they get this through if they push hard, or will there be obstacles along the way?
Unfortunately, and I work for the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation, by the way, but unfortunately, the stars are perfectly aligned for them in this regard, and it will be up to the leaders in Congress who are opposed to privatization to really stand up and to illuminate for the country how the arguments made by privatizers are disingenuous and in some respects even outright lies with regards to what it does and does not do. It's up to us to educate the public and to pressure the public to call into their Republican and Democratic members of Congress and to the president to say that they simply will not stand this. This represents represents a reversal that our country cannot afford to, the path that we cannot afford to go down. And so the American people absolutely have to pay attention and rise up and say, absolutely, this will not happen. Unfortunately, you're absolutely right. The Republicans or the conservatives control the Congress. They control the White House. And so the prospects for this, if people do not organize correctly, it could actually take effect and to the detriment of Americans for generations to come.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And that was Maya Rockymore, who is, let me get her exact title, the Vice President of Research and Programs at the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation. And she also had previously served as a staffer in the House of Representatives Ways and Means Committee and co-editor of a book called Strengthening Communities, Social Insurance in a Diverse America, and author of a book, The Political Action Handbook, How-To Guide for the Hip-Hop Generation. And let's take a little musical break to set up the next interview. That's the New York Dolls doing the Bo Diddley song, Pills, and it's appropriate setup for the next interview, which is with Merrill Guzner. Guzner is the director of the Integrity and Science Project, the Center for Science and the Public Interest in D.C., and is author of the book, The $800 Million Pill, The Truth Behind the Cost of New Drugs. I had him on to talk about that book when it came out. So I thought with drug recalls in the news, it would be a good time to talk with him again. So let's listen to the first part of this interview with Merrill Guzner.
Let's start just by getting a bit of the lay of the land here. Why is the U.S. pharmaceutical industry about the most profitable undertaking on the face of the earth?
Well, the drug industry has a very low manufacturing costs, so that for each extra unit sold, they make extraordinary profits, which is why you see the tremendous amount of marketing that goes on. And the amount that they spend on research and development and all the things that go into making drugs just pales beyond the kind of prices that they can command, given their both political and economic power.
And I believe I asked you this question when we were talking about your book, The $800 Million Pill, but in other fields, especially electronics and such, technological advances result in prices dropping like a rock. Why has this technological miracle not extended to drugs and the medical industry in general?
Well, I think there's two explanations for that. One is the kind of patent system, which provides the drug industry with exclusivity when a new drug comes on the market. However, there is the potential for different drugs to compete for the same condition, so that any time a new medicine comes out for heart disease or lowering cholesterol or treating allergies or whatever it might be, there is various chemical mutations of the same in the same class of drug that can become different drugs, so people can get different companies can get different patents. But then what happens in the marketplace is that you have cartel-like behavior in which the pricing structure for all drugs in the class, as long as they're on patent, is extraordinarily high vis-a-vis what the price might be if all the drugs were generic. So it's a combination of the patent system and cartel-like behavior that allows them to do the kind of pricing, get away with the kind of pricing that they get away with.
Of course, the industry says, when questioned, that they need these high profits to pay for their massive R&D costs. What's the truth of that?
Well, the fact of the matter is that significant breakthroughs in medicine are quite rare. And when something comes along, it often is the product of years and years of research that took place in the public sector. The industry does spend about 20% of its revenue on R&D, but a significant chunk of that, I would estimate at least half, goes to what could more accurately be called marketing-oriented research. It's drugs to replicate, you know, either to replace drugs that are coming off patent that basically do the same thing. They are drugs that are more classically the Me Too drugs. So in other words, there's three or four companies out there that have got a great market, say, in cholesterol-lowering drugs. I don't have one. Let me come up with a molecule that's sort of like theirs but is just slightly different, and then that's my entry into that market. So it doesn't provide anything clinically important or new for physicians, but allows a company to compete in that space, and then that cartel-like pricing behavior takes over so that they get a chunk of a market but never really threaten the pricing structure of the market to get that chunk. And so that argument, which is that they're spending all this money on the next new generation of cures, is also just sort of a smokescreen to justify high prices.
How does this cartel-like arrangement work? It's not like they get together at the country club and plot their pricing strategy, is it? Does it work with nods and winks or what?
Well, it's everybody applying the same set of rules. I think it is the gentleman's agreement that I'm not going to go after you using pricing. You could say that the same thing, you know, when you have so few car companies out there, why doesn't it apply to car companies? Well, the difference is that the car companies operate on a 5% margin and the drug companies operate on a 30% margin. I mean, traditional economic theory would suggest when you have 5 or 6 or 8 companies competing in the same class of drugs, say cholesterol-lowering drugs or heart medications, and everybody is getting a 30% return on sales in terms of their profit margin, that you would see some price competition, because I can grab market share from you by only taking 20%, which for many industries would be perfectly adequate, and yet you don't see it go on. And what can you describe it to? A meeting in a back room? I doubt it. It's just more that, you know, this is the industry's way, you know, the way it operates. And there's a kind of gentleman's agreement too, that they don't go after each other at that level. They compete. You know, this was actually settled way back in the 1950s, believe it or not, when there was a Federal Trade Commission investigation into all of this. When it was in those days, it was called the Antibiotic Cartel. And they decided that, you know, competition was served by the fact that they competed on other modalities, things like number of times a day that you might take the drug, or the color of the pill, or one's a shot versus one's a pill, or whatever. So in other words, the drug industry meets the government's test, the historic test, antitrust law test of competition by things other than price. So there was experience there that they all are part of their collective memory that basically allows them to sort of ascribe to the common set of rules. You would need a whole different government approach to antitrust in order to sort of break that gentleman's agreement.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
I took a pounding from the radio today. I heard the radio say it over and over, and there was no escape.
This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and this is Iggy Pop.
It was one of my heroes, James Osterberg. The show is Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and let's go into the second part of the interview with Merrill Guzner, who is with the Center for Science and Public Interest in Washington, D.C., and author of the book The $800 Million Pill.
Let's talk about the current crisis, then. Several pain drugs have been revealed to have very nasty side effects. So could you just review the basic news items first?
It all started with Merck back in late October when they withdrew Vioxx, which is a painkiller. It's taken by millions of people, mostly older, although occasionally by younger people when they have an incident that leads to pain. But the chronic users of these painkillers are older people who have suffered from either arthritis or osteoarthritis or rheumatoid arthritis. And, of course, there's millions of people across the country who suffer from those diseases. And, the Merck, there was a cancer trial. Merck, like many of the companies that made this new class of drug, which were called COX-2 inhibitors for their mode of action, they were looking to look for new uses for them. And so they were trying it in cancer trials. And what these trials turned up was, in fact, corroboration of evidence that actually came out 4 years ago, and there's a long story behind it, but that these COX-2 inhibitors actually increased the risk of heart attacks and other cardiovascular problems among people taking them. Now, in all accuracy, you got to remember that the risk of cardiovascular problems from taking these drugs is relatively small. In other words, if you had 1,000 people for a year or 18 months, maybe 15 people would have a heart attack instead of 7.5 took a placebo. But the fact that it doubled heart attacks, and so Merck withdrew its drug from the market. The same was true of Pfizer's Celebrex, which is the best-selling one in that class. That came out in a NIH-funded study where they were testing it to combat colon polyps. And then there was some similar things for Bextra, another COX-2 inhibitor. And then, of course, we're seeing that somebody mentioned that naproxen in one Aleve trial, and the data on that was very scanty. And, in fact, the original trial with Vioxx showed that naproxen, like aspirin, had a positive cardiovascular benefit. So I am very dubious about this latest one and want to see the full data when that comes out. But the point is that these drugs were sold as some kind of super aspirins to replace older drugs like naproxen, which is Aleve, or ibuprofen, which is very common on the market, but in the generic version and over-the-counter, and even traditional aspirin. These new super drugs, Celebrex and Vioxx, were sold as super aspirins, even though their pain relief was no different than the pain relief offered by the traditional painkillers. But they were sold also to the physicians as this will reduce the side effect of GI effects, which I like to point out, this problem only affected somewhere, it depends on which drug, but the FDA says on its label 2 to 4% of patients, and that's only if you stick scopes down into their GI tract. If you're talking about serious complications like GI bleeds or ulcers, it actually only affected 1 to 1.5% of patients. And the only one of these drugs that ever proved that it reduced the GI bleeds was Vioxx. And in that trial, it increased the risk of heart attacks. So here you have it, a drug that when you look at 1.5%, suffer from GI effects from taking naproxen, all right? You cut that in half, right? So it's actually, in the trial, it went from 1.4 down to 0.6 or 0.8 or 8 per thousand reduced serious GI complications. For what? In the Celebrex trial, you doubled the risk of heart attacks to 7.5 per thousand, to 15 per thousand over 7.5. The point is, for the same pain relief, you were trading the risk of an ulcer for the risk of a heart attack. What patient would know, knowing both of those facts, would make that trade-off?
And, of course, for the other 96 or 98% of the population, they'd be better off just taking aspirin, right?
Ibuprofen, I mean, the fact is that you can go down to the drugstore without going to the doctor, buy this over-the-counter for arthritis pain or the occasional pain, and pay $10 for, you know, if it's a chronic problem and you're taking it every day for a three-month supply, instead of the $90 a month it's costing you for these prescription drugs. And, of course, that was really the point of these drug companies developing these drugs. Yes, there was an argument in the medical literature about the problem of GI problems associated with what are called non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, ibuprofen, naproxen, aspirin. They're called NSAIDs in the literature. And there's a huge discussion in the medical literature, much of it funded by drug companies, about the seriousness of this problem. They come up with a new class of drugs that might get rid of it. Well, you know, in the best of all possible worlds, you might say, well, you know, we would pay for that if it really got rid of the problem. Turned out that most of the drugs didn't really even get rid of the problem. The problem wasn't that big in the first place. And the risks that were associated with taking it were just as big as the problem you had just set out to solve and was a worse problem. So, you know, this was something that the drug industries wanted to do because the older pain relievers had gone off patent, had now gone generic, had gone over the counter. That whole cash flow disappeared, and they wanted to replace it.
And, of course, their biggest dream is a very expensive drug that you have to take every day for the rest of your life, right?
Well, and for arthritis sufferers, that describes their reality. I mean, my mom, bless her heart, in a nursing home, has suffered from, arthritis severely, you know, for several decades now, and she pops ibuprofen every day. And the point is that it helps her cope with the pain. And, of course, she doesn't need Celebrex or Vioxx because she doesn't have a stomach problem. If she did, then you might consider it. But, of course, that was never the way these drugs were marketed. The direct-to-consumer advertising for Celebrex and Vioxx, they would show these frisky seniors frolicking through fields of flowers as if somehow these were some super pain medication that would do something for your arthritis other than relieve the pain symptoms. Immediate pain symptoms. It doesn't do anything for arthritis. The arthritis remains. You don't have any greater physical ability other than that if you can work through the pain, you can work through the pain better. That's what pain relievers do. They didn't cure the problem.
Yeah, let's talk a bit about this direct-to-consumer advertising. It popped up, 10 or 20 years ago, and then now it's a very heavy feature of TV.
Well, in fact, the electronic direct-to-consumer advertising didn't appear until 1997. It was really a very recent liberalization, if you can use that word, at the Food and Drug Administration as part of the Modernization Act that they passed back then for the FDA, at the behest of the pharmaceutical industry that enabled direct-to-consumer advertising. It's got to be rolled back. This is just confusing the marketplace that really should be driven by objective evidence with doctors' prescriptions. I mean, why on earth would lay people be going into physicians' offices and demanding a particular medicine that they saw on television? What do they know about? What do I know about this? I mean, I know more than most because I study this stuff. How many people are studying the clinical trials that appear in the medical literature? How many people are qualified to really study the clinical trials that appear in the literature and then make prescribing decisions? This is why we have physicians. This is why you pay them $100 for a visit. You know, that's their job. you don't need to intervene. I mean, it's good to be knowledgeable. It's good to look up information. A knowledgeable consumer, if you got all the information, would be a good thing. But are you getting all the information from an advertisement placed on television? That's absurd.
You alluded to this earlier, the influence of the drug industry on clinical trials. So let's talk a bit about this. First of all, well, let's start with the FDA. The FDA 40 years ago was one of the, after the thalidomide crisis, was very strict, and drug approval in the U.S. also often lagged behind that abroad. And now we have one of the most rapid drug approval processes in the world. What happened?
Well, I think most of the, there were two laws, essentially, lobbied for by the pharmaceutical industry that got passed in the 1990s that significantly loosened the agency's ability to do its job well. The first was in 1992, which was the User Fee Act, which had basically the drug industry was claiming that the FDA took too long to approve new drugs when the industry submitted its clinical trials and applications for new drugs. And, you know, I can't remember the exact numbers. It might have been 2 years. It's since been reduced to about a year or even less. As a result, with the laws, the industry provided user fee. In other words, when you made your application, you would pay a fee. And so there actually became a direct tie between the industry paying money and the agency then hiring staff or contractors to do the evaluations of new drug applications. Well, like anything else, if you know that your money is coming from the company in order to do your job, you know, there's a little bias built into that to say maybe I better fudge things a little bit more in their direction because they may not come back. And, you know, it's like, let's please the customer becomes the kind of underlying psychology. And that began to take over. That was coupled really with, you know, a sort of really just intensified interest in society, abetted in many ways by the media, with the idea that there's all these new medical breakthroughs about to come through. And there were some new medical breakthroughs that were coming down the pike in that period. You've got to remember, that was a period, too, when the AIDS crisis was going on. So that there was a lot of pressure from all over the map to say, liberalize what you're doing. Make it easier for us to get experimental drugs. Approve drugs more quickly so that we can deal with some of these pressing medical problems. So, you know, it wasn't just the drug industry. There was a lot of social pressure for them to just sort of sign on to the idea that, you know, the medical miracles are right around the corner, and all we have to do is loosen up a little bit, and there'll be a tidal wave of new innovation in pharmaceuticals. The 97 law, which I alluded to a little bit earlier, was just an extension of that. Well, you can say it was an overreaction that went on at the agency, but in fact, you know, I think what happened, you know, the agency, I think, still holds on to its mission of protecting the American public with regard to the fact that drugs are safe and that they're effective, which is the two main criteria. I don't think they go far enough today, and we could talk about that, but I think it still has that as its mission. It's not completely taken over by the drug industry, but I think the subtle ties with the industry, the way it often collaborates with the industry today, in other programs that it has, the pressure from the patient groups, many of themselves now funded by the drug industry, has created a climate on which we've created an unrealistic expectation that every drug that comes down the pike is some big medical breakthrough, and that created an environment in which the drug industry could slip through with all these new, what are essentially me-too drugs that really add nothing to physicians' armamentarium for fighting disease. And of course, if it worked, if it's better than placebo, and they only have a small study that says it's safe in this limited number of patients, which is enough to get it approved in this new environment, and then boom, what do you have? You have drugs that once they're out there in the marketplace, we find out they're unsafe. And since the laws have been liberalized, you've seen more drugs withdrawn from the market than in any time in FDA history, except since the 1960s, when in the wake of a 1962 law, which first put in efficacy testing for the first time in the wake of the thalidomide crisis, that you had literally hundreds of drugs withdrawn from the market because they simply didn't do what they claimed to do.
I'm speaking with Merrill Guzner, who is the with the Center for Science and the Public Interest and author of the book, The $800 Million Pill, The Truth Behind the Cost of New Drugs. And let's talk a little bit about the relation between doctors and the industry. How does the industry seduce physicians into writing those very lucrative prescriptions?
I suppose the easiest answer to that question is in every way imaginable. From an army of salespeople called detailers in the trade showing up in their doors, buying lunch for the staff, giving out pads and pencils. That's the unsubtle part. The subtle part is by handing out studies that they've, you know, reprints of studies that appear in second-tier academic journals that, you know, to claim that the drugs do things for diseases that they've never proven it to the FDA's satisfaction, but why don't you prescribe this off-label? They have to, every doctor in every state in this country has to have their license renewed every year or every couple of years, and they have to take a certain number of continuing medical education courses. 90% of continuing medical education courses today are underwritten by the drug companies. Many of the presenters at those courses are themselves consultants for drug companies, doctors who are so-called thought leaders in the field. You know, if you go to the major trade associations for physicians, you know, the American Heart, you know, the cardiologists or the oncologists, or anytime they have their big annual meetings, 15,000 doctors those go up. You go to the display booths at one of these conventions, and it's all drug companies, you know, giving out all manner of freebies. The marketing of drugs to physicians is an industry in and of itself, probably costing $30 billion a year to drug consumers. Instead of these physicians getting objective information from agencies of the government or someplace that has basically said, we're going to evaluate all the evidence there and we're going to put out best practice clinical practice guidelines that we think you ought to adhere to, and we don't ourselves have any tie to the industry, but what we've done is try to evaluate the evidence and say what would be best for the American people, for most people, and this is how you should treat people. We don't have evidence-based medicine in this country. We have marketing-based medicine in this country, and we need to move from marketing-based medicine to evidence-based medicine.
And let's talk in the final section here about the what is to be done question. First of all, we really don't have a very good mechanism for following up on drugs once they've been approved. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. The one of the major reforms that is being talked about today, and of course the subject of my op-ed would say I don't think that goes far enough, but is just to create an independent safety agency either inside the FDA completely removed from the drug approval arm or an independent agency itself that will go out and do the post-marketing surveillance to determine if drugs are generating side effects in the population that is using them, that therefore get a real early warning system and the information needed to withdraw drugs from the market that are proving dangerous to a significant subset of the population that's taking them. But you see, I don't think that goes far enough. I mean, great, and if we could just get that much, that would be wonderful. But the fact is that when you think about the marketing stuff we were just talking about, that reform really doesn't go far enough. We really need to get the drug industry, the device manufacturing industry, the test manufacturing industry, we need to get commerce out of the generation of evidence in medicine. And we need to get the practice of medicine based on objective evidence. And you need to create new institutes and new institute at NIH to generate that kind of information that could be sent over to the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services so that government payment decisions are based on that kind of evidence, and therefore so that the American people can know that the medicine that they're being offered has not been driven by commerce or somebody's self-interest, but has been driven by what is best for their health.
And then finally, what about the relation between doctors and the industry? What can be done about that?
Well, I think this is where the medical profession itself has to take the bull by the horns and just simply say, you know, they can sit there at the AMA and pass along and say, forget it. Doctors is part of the, you know, guideline that we offer. Every one of you should just say, no more reps, come in. You know, if you need information about what new drugs are out there, call the journal up and buy a reprint, you know, or go to an institute and, you know, and get a clinical practice guideline that's been created objectively. Why are you taking your medical information for what drugs to prescribe by some 30, 35-year-old MBA salesperson who's coming to your door and has learned enough medicine to hand out, a medical journal article that's been reprinted and made part of their, you know, black bag of salesman tricks. That's no way to get your medical education, your postgraduate medical education.
But I would suspect that the current environment in Washington is actually not conducive to any of the kinds of things you're talking about, is it?
No. Somebody asked me this question the other day, and I said, I think I'm sort of in the think tank mode at this point. I think if we're going to have, let me put this in a broader social context. People have been talking about Social Security reform in recent weeks because President Bush wants to push what I consider to be a swindle on the American public. But the real crisis in our system has nothing to do with financing crisis. It has nothing to do with Social Security. It has to do with Medicare. It's twice as big as Social Security. We have, it has none of the trust fund money that the Social Security system has, and it's going to run out of money in another 5 or 6 or 8 years. I forget the exact date. And its costs are increasing by 10 to 12% a year because healthcare costs are rising out of control. All these kinds of reforms that we're talking about now are going to be on the table within the next decade in order to deal with the skyrocketing cost of healthcare. We have to control healthcare costs or it's going to bankrupt our government. And that, in the end, is all of us. And in order to deal with that and still have we can deal with that and have a more effective healthcare system if we wisely use our money by giving effective care and determining what is the most cost-effective medicine. Does buying the latest Me Too drug that the drug industry is pushing that offers the same pain relief, increases your heart attack risk, and doesn't do really anything, to deal with a small GI effect risk, is that an effective use of dollars? These COX-2 inhibitors generated $10 billion in sales for these companies each in this decade. You know, there's $3, $4 billion a year coming from these drugs. That's a lot of money. If that can be more, and if you can get the same pain relief with minimal risk by buying over-the-counter ibuprofen, and you've just saved $8 billion, that's real savings. And that's the kind of evidence we need. That's the kind of system we're going to have to enact if we're not going to have the healthcare system in this country, which already can't provide insurance to 45 million people, if we're going to insure everyone and if we're going to have a healthcare system that can actually provide good, affordable healthcare to all the American people.
I've been speaking with Merrill Guzner, director of the Integrity and Science Project at the Center for Science and the Public Interest based in Washington, D.C., and he's the author of the book, The $800 Million Pill, The Truth Behind the Cost of New Drugs. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. I'll be back next week on recording with a show on inequality in America, public opinion and the reality and the causes and all that. And let's go out in a seasonally appropriate hardcore version of Silent Night, performed by Bad Religion and NoFX.